Hello, James. Welcome to our show in Croatia.
Hello, and thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, pleasure is mine. Well, people in Croatia knows your work, but just a few sentences for people who maybe not.
My name is James Corbett. I am living and working here in Japan, where I've been for the last 20 years. And for the last 17 years, I've been running the Corbett Report, which is a news and information website with podcasts, videos, articles, interviews, and other free media about news and information that's happening all around the world.
And you made one great documentary about future of food. And I would like to discuss about this today. What motivates you to make this documentary?
I think there are a number of things that are converging right now to create a crisis or a coming crisis in the food supply that threatens to completely transform what it means to even have a food chain and what that food chain will look like in the near future. And people may or may not be aware of some of those changes that are happening right now. For example, we've seen the rollout of the fake meat substitutes in recent years and other such innovative new food products that we're told will somehow appease the weather gods and change the climate or something like that. At any rate, it is starting to happen and people are starting to notice. But the types of transformative technologies that are coming into view are so crazy, so amazing, so even far beyond genetic modification and the other types of technologies that we've become used to, that I don't think people are really ready for it or understand what is about to happen. And all of that would be, I suppose, bad enough, even if this was being guided by wonderful people with wonderful intentions for humanity. But I think people with bad intentions for humanity are steering over this process and using it to consolidate an unprecedented amount of control over the human population.
Let's go through this process.
From the Netherlands to Ireland to Poland to Italy to Canada to Argentina to Sri Lanka, governments are cracking down on farmers, forcing them to cull herds, lower production, dump milk, and comply with onerous new operating restrictions in the name of reducing pollution. These governments are not stupid. Like the British, the Soviets, the Americans, and other repressive regimes throughout history, they know that these measures, if played out to their conclusion, will result in widespread hunger and unrest. In fact, we've already seen massive protests against these restrictions in numerous countries, from Germany to Italy to Poland to Spain to Panama to Argentina to Canada. And that's to say nothing of the mass Dutch farmer protests in recent years and Sri Lankans running their president out of the country when it became obvious that the government's green policies and farming restrictions had contributed to the collapse of that nation's economy.
Well, we are facing in the European Union lots of protests from side of agriculture community. In Croatia, we also had a few months ago because of swine plague, exactly what they call it, swine flu. Can you comment why is this happening?
Yes, it is not hard to see why this is happening, not only in Europe, but around the world. Farmers are rising up because government after government around the world, almost as if in a coordinated fashion, are implementing the same types of crackdowns on basic farming practices and farming inputs, like nitrogen fertilizers and other basic parts of the modern agricultural farming system, to make it more and more difficult for the average farmer to be able to do their job and to actually provide food for people. It is becoming, at times, it is already a very perilous industry to be involved with because it is on razor-thin margins and a bad crop can ruin a farmer. Well, it's getting even worse when it seems the governments themselves are now attacking the farmers. And there are many instances in many countries around the world where governments would literally rather pay farmers not to farm than to farm. And we've seen a number of programs like that. And of course, the worst of all worlds is that these types of crackdowns are making it more and more difficult for small farmers to compete with the big agricultural giants. And so it is, I think, quite obvious, an obvious reaction that people around the world are rising up against this, the farmers first and foremost. But the real question then is, why? Whose benefit is this? Does this accrue to? And why are governments cracking down on their own farmers? If these people are literally feeding the population, why would governments be working against them?
Yeah. And answer is they want to protect our climate. They want to protect our climate changes because the main reason for climate changes is greenhouse gases coming from farming.
That is the idea that they are putting out for the public. Thankfully, not a lot of people are buying that at this point, as they see that prediction after prediction after prediction about global warming has been wrong for the past few decades. And that doesn't seem to be changing anytime in the current time frame either, especially as, the types of doom and gloom forecasts that predicted the end of the world by this point have failed to come true. So people are not buying it. But yes, we have seen the ridiculous propounding of this idea by people like King Charles, then Prince Charles, and others, going so far as to advocate that we start putting masks on cattle to prevent their burps from going out into the atmosphere, as if we can literally control the weather by controlling the emissions from farms. And again, this is a cover story for a much deeper story that's about consolidation of control over the most fundamental human resource. It's often said that Henry Kissinger has said a famous quote about control the food and control the people. Well, there's no good source on that quotation, so Kissinger may or may not have said it, but we do know that he wrote a national security memorandum, number 200, back in the 1970s, in which he argued that the growing global population was a threat to the United States specifically, and that the U.S. could use food aid as a type of leverage to get various nations around the world to implement population controls of various sorts. And I think what that speaks to is the fundamental underlying nature of food itself. Of course, food is the most fundamental and important resource for humanity. And if you can consolidate control over that resource, you have an unprecedented power over the population. I think the farmers in that case are the first line of defense against that attack against humanity. And that is why we see farmers rising up in such numbers today.
40,000 pounds of food meant to feed people in a food desert near Maricopa, south of the valley, is completely gone. And tonight, investigators are still trying to figure out what caused the fire.
News out of Pasco County. Crews battling a huge fire at a chicken farm. It's all happening on Cowmaine Foods along Simpson Farm Lane in Dade City.
Firefighters trying to figure out what sparked a fire at a food processing plant on the west side. It happened around 9:30 last night on Merida Street near South Zarzamora.
Breaking news in eastern Oregon, where crews are battling a major fire at a potato chip processing plant. Air 12 flew over the scene at Shearer's Foods on Highway 207 in Hermiston.
Crews were on the scene of a massive fire at an egg farm earlier this afternoon. The fire broke out at the Hillendale Farms location on Schwartz Road. The Salvation Army says around 100,000 chickens may have died in that fire.
A series of mysterious fires, explosions, incidents of arson, and even cyber attacks on food processing facilities across the United States in recent years has prompted law enforcement agencies to warn of a coordinated attack on the food supply. In April 2022, the FBI even issued an official notice to private industry warning that ransomware attacks against the entire farm-to-table spectrum of the food and agriculture sector occur on a regular basis, and noting that such attacks are disrupting operations, causing financial loss, and negatively impacting the food supply chain. This mysterious attack has taken place at the same time as a massive disruption of the global food supply has left the world one crisis away from disaster. With nitrogen fertilizer shortages fueling food inflation, even as governments around the world crack down on their farmers' use of fertilizers and farming inputs, and with war, drought, and trade disruptions also playing havoc on food production, the global farm-to-fork system's ability to feed the world's population is coming into question.
Well, we are witnessing in the United States especially, and in Canada, lots of incidents in farming and in food production. You think this is coordinated and has some purpose?
Well, let's put it this way. I think if there's one thing that we've learned over the course of the 21st century, it's that people generally respond to crises in a way that allows for the types of changes to society that otherwise would not take place. For example, an event like 9/11 in the United States creates a complete changeover in the mindset of the public that allows, say, the American public to adopt the Department of Homeland Security and put their country on essentially an indefinite war footing. Or, for example, the global financial crisis creates the desire in the public for a completely new global financial regulatory infrastructure. Or, say, the perceived threat of a spreading disease justifies, in the minds of many millions of people around the world, the dawning of absolutely unprecedented lockdowns and biosecurity measures. So, if you were looking to do a complete transformation of the food supply and the food chain, one thing you would likely want to do is to get the public on board with that transformation by creating, at the very least, the sense of a crisis in that food supply. And there are many ways that that can happen. And I think part of what I'm showing in this documentary is that the attack on the food supply that we are experiencing right now is literal as well as figurative. Yes, there are, of course, the restrictions that the governments around the world are imposing on the farmers, as we talked about before, but there are also literal attacks, arson attacks that are happening at an unprecedented rate, for example, in the United States, as I was pointing out in that documentary. And there are other disruptions that we could point to, the disruptions that are taking place because of international conflicts, etc. So there is an attack that's happening right now, and I think that is feeding into a sense of crisis. And this isn't, again, this isn't something that just is spontaneously occurring out of the ether that hasn't been thought about before. In fact, it's been precisely wargamed time and time again. And in this documentary, I go on to talk about two of those planning exercises, one called the Food Chain Reaction Game that took place back in 2015, and one in just earlier this year in which the EU was talking about the possibility of widespread farmer revolts and disruption of the food supply, etc., that might lead to rioting and other such things. And I think in every case where we see this being wargamed and strategized, the idea is to then bring in drastic alterations to the food chain itself, and ultimately the transformation of that food supply that we're talking about.
Yeah, we'll come to this, what you mentioned, that just we also in Europe facing one war, big war between Russia and Ukraine. At the same time, Ukraine is a big agricultural country, and we also facing increasing price in inflation, and they told us that this war is reason for inflation in food supply.
Well, there is no doubt that the Ukraine has been the breadbasket. It was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union back in Soviet times. It is the breadbasket of Eastern Europe. It is an incredibly important agricultural area. And the fact that it is engaged in heavy fighting at the moment certainly does make parts of those exports of those crops much more difficult. So there is to be expected a disruption in food supply that comes from events like that. And that feeds into a food in a price inflation that's happening. Although I would say that's probably not the only factor that is contributing to that inflation, but it certainly is a factor. And once again, I think it's a perfectly predictable factor of the type of geopolitical crises that are being manufactured on the international scale. In November of 2015, as you can learn from an official press release on the Cargill website, 65 international policymakers, academics, business and thought leaders gathered at the World Wildlife Fund's headquarters in Washington, D.C. to game out how the world would respond to a future food crisis. Over the course of 2 days, the participants in this food chain reaction crisis simulation role-played a response to a number of converging and overlapping catastrophes in the 2020s, including two major food crises with prices approaching 400% of the long-term average, a raft of climate-related extreme weather events, governments toppling in Pakistan and Ukraine, and famine and refugee crises in Bangladesh, Myanmar, Chad, and Sudan. The game, which, we are assured, was built over the course of months with maximal realism in mind, went on to envision some very specific scenarios that bear an eerie resemblance to current-day reality, including a steep price spike with looming global food shortages in 2022 that prompted the EU players to impose a tax on meat. Lest the meaning of this exercise be lost on the general public, The World Wildlife Fund went on to spell it out in their after-action report on the simulation. Only by stopping agricultural expansion, augmenting agricultural production, increasing resource use efficiency, and reducing food waste can we provide the food and nourishment we need while ensuring we are conserving nature for future generations. Accordingly, this game ended with the imposition of a global carbon tax. In February 2024, the European Union ran its own food crisis simulation. The exercise, which brought 60 EU and government officials together for a two-day conference in Brussels, envisioned a cascading series of food emergencies unfolding over the next 2 years, from harvest failures and fertilizer shortages to popular uprisings and unrest. The war game ended, predictably enough, with the government bureaucrats calling for more centralization of food reserves and stockpiles in the name of biosecurity, and concluding that diets need to shift toward healthier options and away from meat. This EU crisis simulation and the food chain reaction exercise, combined with a series of government and NGO-sponsored awareness campaigns related to food security, including the Rockefeller Foundation's Reset the Table report calling for further consolidation of the global food supply, and the Chinese government's Clean Your Plate campaign, which aims to bring technocratic management of the economy into every citizen's dining room, throw the current round of mysterious and unexplained attacks on food processors and farmers into stark relief. Together, these campaigns and exercises suggest that the current food crisis is not a naturally occurring event, but a deliberately engineered phenomenon.
This reminds me on one event called Event 201, what happened in 2019, October, just few months before pandemic starts. They're simulating a new potential pandemic, and everything happened as they predicted, and we faced 3 years of pandemic. What is your comment?
Yes, for those who don't know, please do look into Event 201, the simulation of a spreading coronavirus pandemic just a few months before we are asked to believe that really took place. But yes, it seems that these types of event simulations can be more than simply predictions, but actually part of an ongoing unfolding plot. And if that is the case, then what does that portend for what we are facing? Look, for example, at the food chain reaction game that we just saw the information about there, and look at what they ultimately concluded in their after action report, that one of the ways that we will have to head off this crisis is by stopping agricultural expansion. So we are led to believe that we're going to stop somehow this food crisis from taking place by actually stopping agricultural expansion. Surely they mean continuing or growing agricultural expansion. We need more farms and more farmers and more people producing more food to head off starvation, don't we? Well, no, not in the food of the future. With the new technologies that are coming into view, in which we won't need to produce food from the abundance of the earth the way humans have been doing it throughout all of human history. No. We have brand new technologies that will allow us to create all sorts of weird, mysterious Frankenfood or food-like substances in the labs. And if that isn't enough to feed people, we'll also have insects and other such foodstuffs that we never thought of as being good for you before, but we'll learn how to love those types of foods. And if you think that I'm making that up, well, I have plenty of information in this documentary about that too. But yes, I think that is why these types of simulations are taking place. Generally, they are to let people in those positions of power and authority know that when they see these sorts of things happening, for example, we saw the footage of that EU crisis, food crisis simulation event that took place earlier this year, in which they are predicting riots and unrest and civil war, essentially, over food shortages and the like. When you see that taking place, we will know what to do, and we will know how to implement the types of things like carbon taxes and other centralization of control in order to take care of that situation. So I think that is one of the key reasons that these simulations happen, is to prepare the people who will then be in the positions to do those exact things.
Yeah, for me it's strange when you have increasement of CO2 at the greenhouse, you have a greening as effect, and also it's a better crop, better yield. And still, we are fighting against it. Why we are maybe facing a food shortage? It doesn't have any sense.
Exactly right. You are exactly right about that. In fact, was it NASA or one of the main U.S. agencies just recently came out to document and quantify the amount of greening that has taken place on the Earth in the 21st century as a result of this warming temperature that we're asked to believe is this runaway, unprecedented warming. There are many things to say about that. But anyway, the documented greening of the Earth is surely a good thing, isn't it? And certainly, if we are facing food scarcity, the idea that the Earth is more agriculturally productive must be a good thing. But somehow we're being asked to believe that that is actually part of the problem. And we shouldn't be looking into all of the ways that this food crisis is being deliberately engineered. Well, I will trust your viewers to come to their own decisions about that. But once they do examine the evidence and realize that there is a food crisis being generated, then the real question is why and who? Who is doing this and for what purpose? And perhaps more to the point, what can we actually do about it? Moving beyond the simple insertion of foreign genes into an organism, scientists are now working on creating foodstuffs from designer microbes, engineering organisms into bioreactors that can be used to grow proteins and other materials for food production, growing meat-like products from cells in the laboratory, and dozens of other zany ideas.
The meat of the future will likely be lab-grown. Compared to our conventional methods of getting meat on the table, lab-grown meat, which debuted in 2013, doesn't involve slaughtering of animals, nor does it require as many environmental resources.
Hey, smart people. Joe here. I'm about to be one of the first people on Earth to eat real chicken grown entirely in a lab. That's right. We're talking the most futuristic nuggets ever.
Nearly 90% of Americans eat meat as a part of their diet. But earlier this year, the Agriculture Department approved production of what's known as cultivated meat, that is chicken grown in a lab.
This machine is 3D printing steak. The goal is to create a piece of meat without killing a cow. And this Israeli startup is one of the dozens of companies racing to perfect the process.
It turns out that cows aren't necessarily the most efficient way of making beef.
After a near decade-long PR campaign, you've probably heard of Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat, companies that employ the latest techniques in chemical engineering to create plant-based meat substitutes. But there are many more technologies around the corner that threaten to transform our food supply in even more bewildering ways. Scientists are bioengineering spores that can be inserted into crops and livestock, allowing companies to identify and track food products all the way through the food system, from farm to factory to fork.
We use microbes as tracking devices. So what we do is we convert data, digital data, into strands of DNA. We insert that little bit of DNA into a microorganism, a probiotic microorganism, to be honest. And then we can sort of apply that organism and sort of have it hitch a ride on any food or agricultural product or really anything through the supply chain. And what the reason we use a microbe to do it is because we engineer it to go into a spore, or a dormant state that allows it to be impervious to high temperatures and UV light, sort of protect that DNA barcode through transit.
DARPA is doling out multi-million-dollar contracts for researchers to find ways to turn military plastic waste into protein powder for human consumption.
What we're trying to do is to use microbes to take plastic and other inedible plant material and turn that into something that's nutritious.
The idea is to turn components of plastic into protein and other nutrients like fats and sugars. If that sounds kind of gross to you, well,
I don't want to eat plastic either. What we're trying to do is to take that plastic and turn it into something completely different.
A company called Amai Proteins is using genetically engineered microbes to create peptides that taste like sugar but are digested like proteins, a process that, the company brags, allows their product to be legally sold as non-GMO, even though, as they openly admit, these microbes are technically genetically engineered.
Then we grow the protein, we biomanufacture it using yeast, just like you do in a brewery. We harvest the protein to get 100% pure protein. And last, Our ProTaste food technology incorporates the protein to replace up to 70% of the sugar without compromising taste.
Again, I have some deja vu. We had crisis pandemic with C-19, and they brought new solution called mRNA vaccine, and we are now facing, they were playing with our DNA, and now possibility of inserting in our DNA is reality. Again, they are playing something with us. Now they can make meat with implementation of DNA and also make tracking device from it.
Well, I think we should confront this propaganda head on and on its face, even on its own terms, because no one, and I mean no one, can be expected to believe that somehow engineering this type of meat substitute gunk in a laboratory and 3D printing it into existence and putting bioengineered DNA barcodes in it and using fruit flies as bioreactors to create sugars and deriving protein from plastics. No one can believe that these types of processes are more efficient than simply using the abundance of the earth, growing things from the ground, or raising cattle, or doing the other things that humans have been doing for literally however many tens or hundreds of thousands of years. No one can believe that this is more efficient, and nor should they, because last year it was revealed in a study that we really didn't need to say the blindingly obvious, but there is a study that you can look up in which it turns out, who could have guessed it, the meat substitute lab gunk that is being produced for these Beyond Meat and Impossible Burgers and what have you actually has a larger carbon footprint than just meat itself, raising cattle. So even if you take it on its own terms, of course, it's all a complete fraud. But again, I think the question has to become why? Why would they go through this incredible process of trying to convince us that all of this is going to be so efficient and so wonderful for us? It is because what this represents is consolidation of the control of the most basic natural resource, food itself, into the hands of a few corporations that will be manufacturing our allotted food substances through these elaborate processes that you and me, we don't have access to this in the kitchen. We can't just 3D print up a lab meat substitute bio burger or create protein out of plastic or anything else of that sort. No, we have to go to these corporations that will have these laboratories devoted to creating this type of gunk, which is precisely why Beyond Meat, Impossible Burgers, all of these types of corporations are being funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to do their work. And they're also being invested in by the Bill and Melinda Gates Investment Trust, which, oh, by the way, is making money off of these technologies as well. There's a great amount of money to be made in the consolidation of this food, and unfortunately also the possibility for controlling humanity, as you gesture towards with regards to the mRNA vaccines and other such things that have been introduced and foisted upon humanity in the past few years. This type of technology can, of course, re-engineer food into something that is, again, potentially harmful, dangerous, deleterious. If food can be your medicine, well, then it can be your poison as well. And all it would take is to get people eating the wrong types of food to make them permanently sick, so that then you could sell them your bio pharma, big pharma medicines as well to cure them. So it's unfortunately, again, an incredibly profitable system for a very, very few, but not for the vast majority of humanity who will have to suffer through this transformation of what we think of as food.
And during 2021, they implemented digital passport, exactly COVID passport, and who doesn't want to take vaccine has to be controlled. And now, 3 years later, in Europe, it's normal we have a digital ID and they can track whatever we do with this digital ID. I see this meat can be tracking device.
Yes, well, let's think of it this way. As part and parcel of this digital ID infrastructure that's being created, of course, you get things like the vaccine passport. You also get the specter of the central bank digital currencies, which the EU and seemingly every government on the planet is currently experimenting with and thinking about foisting on their populations, which will be able to, of course, track and potentially control every transaction that you are doing in real time. And the government will be able to set restrictions on those transactions. So when and if the population accepts that eating meat is angering the weather gods, so we better stop people from eating so much meat, then the government will swoop in as our saviors to limit how much, say, how much beef you can purchase per year. And if you go over your allotment, oh, no, no, your central bank digital currency won't allow you to purchase that anymore. So there's a lot of different ways that this can feed into an overarching system of control that is ultimately about disempowering the individual, tracking, tracing, and controlling everything that we do, everyone that we meet, everywhere that we go, and everything that we eat.
Whoever wants to see, I made one interview about 15-minute cities, and you can see inside how they're planning to limit our calorie intake and also everything else in our life. But let's see who is standing behind this.
And then there are companies like Indigo Ag, a Boston-based agricultural technology company, and tech companies like EY Global and Microsoft, who are ushering in the new normal of agriculture by, as their thinly disguised corporate PR masquerading as investment news likes to boast, utilizing advanced AI and machine learning techniques to create a revolutionary agronomics platform that boosts farmland sustainability and productivity through next-gen microbiome treatments, digital regenerative content, time series satellite imagery, advanced crop monitoring and data analysis, and grain quality testing.
What if you could predict the best crops to grow using the power of data? Recognize crop disease or pests faster. Connect with vendors seamlessly. Doing all this knowing you control your own data. With data captured from each field and connected to predictive analysis, farmers have an unprecedented view of their crops.
Of course, these technologies will be sold to the public as a way to remarkably improve the boring old food that humanity has relied on for untold millennia. This isn't food, after all. This is food 2.0. Molecular gastronomy will allow for the creation of all sorts of zany and unimaginable dishes, from spherified juices to deep-fried hollandaise to lollipopified octopus. In the nutrigenomical kitchen of the future, the AI systems that plan our meals and assemble our food will be able to precisely tailor our diet to our individual genome, calculating the exact portions of foodstuffs, or lab-grown food substitutes, we need to consume to meet our desired health goals. And who needs a chef? In the future, we'll bring our Star Trekian ideas of the replicator into reality by 3D printing all our food right in our own kitchen.
You're hungry. But instead of whipping up a meal, all you have to do is enter your menu choices into a computer and your dinner appears before you. So magical. It may seem like science fiction, but it isn't. Well, not completely. The future is now, my friends. Is 3D printed food in your future?
Future is now. Well, in the 50s, when I saw first computer, it was big like one house. But after few decades, every one of us has a computer at home. It seems that this will happen here. In every kitchen, we will have a 3D printer for our food.
Let's put it this way. It's not, I think, that we have to be fearful of the technology itself. But I think we should be, at the very least, suspicious of the types of companies, corporations, and foundations that are so intent on making this, putting this idea, normalizing this idea of 3D printed foodstuff rather than, say, growing food in your garden. Because I think what it speaks to is the ultimate aim of completely de-rooting us from nature itself, from working with the earth, from being familiar with the basic ways of providing for ourselves. And the more dependent we become on technology for providing our food and everything else for us, the more helpless we will be in the event of any crisis, real or manufactured, that, say, for example, imagine your power goes out for a week, but all you have in your kitchen is a 3D printer to print you up your whatever gastronomic delight that you're going to eat for dinner that night. Well, you won't be able to eat. So you will then be reliant on food aid because you don't know how to grow things yourself. You don't have any access to the local farmers and the people in your community who actually do grow food. And I think that is the vision that we should be most concerned about. And also, of course, again, we should be thinking about the fact that you are what you eat, as the old adage has it. They always tell you, you are what you eat. Well, if you are eating synthetic, chemically processed food-like substitute, then you're not quite human in the same way that every other human generation has been eating natural substances that are grown in the ground or raised on a farm.
Well, I think they are serious about this because I had the interview and we were talking about Agenda 2030. And they are planned in this agenda first to take over 30% of our land, total land, under control, under state control for protecting environment and climate. And then 50% until, I think, 2050. And 90% will come in 50 years. That means we will live in small cities and everything else will be rented and under control of the government or corporation. We'll see in the next clip. And they will rent for us. They will sell us carbon footprint.
Yes, you are correct about that. I think what we are heading towards, and I think that what that reveals is the monopolization of the natural world, which is really what this is about. This is a resource grab by a handful of connected corporations, foundations, politicians, businessmen, financiers, who realize that using the cover of climate change or whatever other fairy tale that they have to tell to the public, they can essentially monopolize the vast majority of the world's wealth and resources, and steward over it, of course, in the name of keeping you safe from the angry weather gods. And using that, I think we can understand what is happening through those terms in a much more easy to see fashion. Of course, the Agenda 2030 is about taking over more and more of the land. Of course, they're going to try to propel that forward into the 21st century. And of course, it's going to end up with people hemmed into these cities of the future, the smart cities in which you will be told what to do, when to do, and how to do it, and be docked in your social credit score or your CBDCs if you fail to comply. Because that is the technocratic vision which is stewarding these people who are bringing this about. The idea that we should be micromanaged by people who know better. And of course, that is always, always just a cover for the greedy, the rich, the psychopaths at the very top who want all of that control for themselves.
On Fortune, we always have some people who are philanthropists who will help us to transfer this new economy and new future.
To really understand where this agenda is heading and how quickly we are likely to get there if it is not opposed, we need look no further than the story of Future Fields. This company and its product has managed to combine the unholy trinity of fake food, GMOs, bugs, and biotech.
So today I'm here to talk about the humble fruit fly and how one day it could save your life and perhaps all of humanity. So science has given us countless medical miracles. You know, pandemic-stopping vaccines, life-saving therapies. But one of the most impactful things that it's given us and given modern medicine is genetic engineering of biological systems.
Future Fields, a Canadian biotech company, has notified the Canadian government of its intention to commercialize EntoEngine, a type of fruit fly that has been genetically engineered to express a growth factor isolated from cows. This growth factor, it turns out, is an important component of the lab-grown meat recipe, which has so far required the use of fetal bovine serum, a substance extracted from unborn cattle, to grow the meat cells. But now that the EntoEngine has been created, Future Fields is excited to use these flying bioreactors to produce the growth factor faster and more cheaply than before.
Well, it looks like to me that they are members of some kind of cult. Everybody repeating same mantra. First, they saved us from pandemic with vaccines. Now, they will save us from hunger with these bugs and other products.
Yes, and people are really just starting to realize that they're serious about this bug-eating agenda. And everyone, of course, is watching their local news or following events within their own country. But myself, as someone who looks at the global news feeds and looks at what's happening around the world, I see this as a coordinated rollout that is happening everywhere around the world. So yes, it is certainly happening there in Europe, and the EU has approved cricket powder, protein, and other such things for human consumption there in the United in the European Union. But I can say, as someone here in Japan, that the Japanese government is toying with that idea. The Canadian government is toying with it. It's happening in America. It's happening everywhere around the world simultaneously. And as I say, people are just starting to realize, oh, they're really starting to push this idea that we're going to eat bugs to change the weather. But they don't know how much further it goes, because ask the average person on the street, they have no idea about genetically engineered fruit flies acting as bioreactors to produce special types of proteins or what have you, or the other types of just incredible. And I think you're right. This is a type of madness and a type of cult-like behavior. But in most times, in most situations, yes, you might have crazy ideas about, oh, we'll start genetically engineering fruit flies to create this new type of peptide or something. You might have that idea, but you wouldn't get anywhere with that idea unless there was financial backing, unless there was people there that was willing to write checks to make that happen and to bring that about. So, as usual, as we always get told in criminal investigations, follow the money. Where is this coming from? Who is funding this into existence? And then you can start to piece together why this is happening and also how to avoid it from happening altogether.
The Rockefeller family and their namesake foundation are in many ways the progenitors and the architects of the Great Food Reset. From the beginning of the so-called Green Revolution to the so-called Gene Revolution, the Rockefellers have been there, helping to move things along with their philanthropic donations. In the 1940s, they founded the Mexican Agricultural Program in Mexico and the International Basic Economy Corporation in Brazil, both of which have been criticized for hooking farmers on expensive machinery and Rockefeller-supplied petroleum products. This formed the basis of the agribusiness concept that emerged, predictably enough, from the Harvard Business School out of research conducted by Vasily Leontief under a Rockefeller Foundation grant. The Rockefellers' agribusiness model arguably did more to change the course of human civilization in the 20th century than anything other than war. It transformed farming and traditional agriculture into the business-led, input-intensive industrial enterprise that it is today, and led to the creation of the global food supply chain. But the Rockefellers' influence did not end in the 21st century. In 2006, the Rockefeller Foundation co-founded the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, whose stated goal of elevating the single African voice on the world stage is belied by the fact that over 200 organizations have come together to denounce the alliance and its activities, claiming that the group has not only unequivocally failed in its mission, but has actually harmed broader efforts to support African farmers. And in 2020, the Rockefeller Foundation released a report entitled Reset the Table, Meeting the Moment to Transform the U.S. Food System, calling for a further centralization of control over the food supply, including a new integrated nutrition security system. Having explicitly cited the Rockefeller Foundation as one of its main inspirations, it's no surprise that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has emerged to become one of the most important players in the Great Food Reset in recent years. Gates was an important early backer of Impossible Burger and its lab-grown synthetic biology food substitute. He also provided capital to Impossible rival Beyond Meat, until Beyond Stock began to crumble. Miraculously, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation Trust was able to divest itself of its Beyond Meat stock right before the shares tanked in 2019. And, as PleaseStopTheRide.com has pointed out, Gates is also investing millions into hacking your microbiome to re-engineer humans' gut bacteria. Ominously, Bill Gates has also recently become the biggest owner of U.S. farmland, a move that allows him unprecedented control over the future of farming in America. Created in 1961 by executive order, USAID is a U.S. government agency that has participated in subterfuge and counterinsurgency operations in Venezuela, Cuba, Ukraine, and numerous other countries under the guise of providing humanitarian assistance and, of course, food aid. Last year, USAID, in conjunction with Feed the Future, the U.S. government's Global Hunger and Food Security Initiative, released a working paper titled Systemic Solutions for Climate Change Adaptation and Mitigation. The paper argues that a perfect storm of circumstances in which supply chain issues, regional agricultural and nutrition challenges, the ongoing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic, and regional conflict have combined to form a looming food security crisis. Their proposal for addressing this generated crisis includes linking carbon markets to regenerative agriculture in a move that continues the financialization of nature, using ESG scores as a way to pressure companies into acquiescing to the nebulous and ever-changing demands of the food reset agenda, and, of course, the promotion of insects as sustainable sources of proteins. Throughout the document, USAID's leverage over developing countries is referenced no less than 125 times. Given the Kissingerian food as a weapon mentality that is the very basis of USAID and its mission, the document perfectly represents the kind of Rockefeller-inspired, Gates-funded, USAID-promoted, agribusiness-based neocolonialism that people in Africa and elsewhere have been warning about for decades.
Deja vu again. In 2019, Bill and Melinda Gates invested in Moderna. Then we had pandemic in 2020, and he was promoting that we'll not go out of pandemic before we largely vaccinate whole humanity. At the end of 2021, he sold his company, his shares, and earned $500 million. Now we see this again. It's happening with food.
And that is no coincidence. So for people who really want to dive deeply into that, I suggest they go to CorbettReport.com/Gates. I have an entire documentary about who is Bill Gates, where I talked about his investments and his monopolization of the global health system and how that played into the past few years. But yes, we are seeing a similar thing in the food sector. That is not by coincidence. That is by design. And specifically, if you look at the template that the Gates Foundation used for their philanthropy in the agricultural space and the public health space, they were looking to the Rockefeller Foundation, which pioneered this back in the 20th century. And the stories are parallel in a number of ways. John D. Rockefeller was a reviled oil monopolist. Everyone hated him until he started giving his fortune away in all of these wonderful philanthropic endeavors that just happened to suit his own business interests. And one example of that is what the Rockefeller Foundation did in the mid-20th century. It's called the Green Revolution. And if you read the history textbooks, that Green Revolution helped feed a billion people and helped stave off starvation for many people around the world by giving this wonderful agricultural technology to people around the world. What the Rockefeller Foundation really did was create the agribusiness model by which, through the largesse of the U.S. government helping to sponsor this, agricultural technologies would be spread throughout the world and in developing countries so that these farmers who had been farming for untold generations could now use this heavy chemical input, heavily mechanized agricultural system that then, of course, relies on all of these inputs from these big corporations that Rockefeller and the family was invested in. The Gates Foundation is doing a very similar thing now, but with all of this genetic revolution technology and other such things as we've looked at before.
And he also is owner of the big part of land in the United States. And we are just facing in Europe. Ukraine has a great agricultural land, and they are in the middle of the war. And at the same time, we have an European Union fight against agriculture, and Cargill, Monsanto, and BlackRock are buying 12 million hectares of agricultural land in Ukraine, first time in the history.
Yes, this is, again, I think we have to see this through the lens of essentially a monopolization or at least an oligopolization of the world's resources. And that includes a massive land grab that is simultaneously taking place that is facilitated through warfare, and through devious business practices. And whatever it takes in order to consolidate that control, I think these people are willing to go there and to do that. And that's why we're seeing what we're seeing. And it is, again, the identifiable groups that people would recognize, the Gates, the BlackRock, and other such, and oligopoly, I can't say that word, entities that are obviously involved in this agenda, as well as a network and support of many, many, many other foundations, corporations, etc. But again, it is about consolidation of control in very few hands, and that is why we must fight against this agenda.
Yeah. And for the end, but not less important, how we can fight against it?
So the most important part of this documentary really does come at the end, where I think it is truly a wonderful thing that they, them, those, the people who are putting this agenda together, have to invest billions and billions and billions of dollars on propaganda and setting up these elaborate organizations and networks and trying to foist this technology on the public, where really the answer, the solution, is at our fingertips. And it has been all along, literally just getting our fingers dirty in the soil. And that can be literal and figurative. Of course, literally going out and starting to grow something in your garden is one way of counteracting this agenda. Just reconnecting and re-experiencing the earth and its abundance and realizing that, yes, everything we need is already here. We do not need these fancy space age technologies in order to feed the human population. We can do it ourselves. And then once we realize and reconnect with that, finding the people in our communities who can help with that. Because, of course, no person can do it all by themselves. But wherever you are, there are farmers markets, there are cattle sharing and other such ideas that are out there that already exist in your community. And all it takes is reconnecting with that, revivifying that. And we have already thereby overcome this entire agenda. So the buck stops at your dinner plate. You get to decide what you put in your mouth and what you don't, and where you get that food and how you provide for yourself and your family. As long as we still have that choice, it is important that we start making that choice and making it consciously for the reason that we don't want to go down that road of control and consolidation of the food supply.
Thank you, James. Thank you for your work. And I wish you all the best in the future.
Well, thank you for helping to spread this important information.
Evo, dragi narode, čuli ste što kaže gospodin Corbett. Kako će nam izgledati budućnost hrane? Postavimo si pitanje kako će nas natirati da jedemo kupce ili meso printanu 3D printeru. Na stranicama Vlade Republike Hrvatske postoji dio koji se zove Nacionalni plan oporavka i otpornosti ili kako to Europska komisija naziva Next Generation EU. To su sredstva namijenjena za oporavak nakon pandemije, a izvor je zajedničko zaduživanje svih članica od 806 milijardi po sadašnjim cijenama sa povratom do 2058. godine. Vjerojatno se zato zove Next Generation jer će otplaćivati iduće generacije. To je posljedica promašenih političkih odluka nazvanih pandemijske mjere, ali o tome ćemo drugom prilikom. Zašto to sada spominjem? Od sredstava povučenih iz tog zaduženja 20% mora ići za digitalizaciju, a čak 36% za borbu protiv klimatskih promjena. Kao najveći razlog emisije stakleničkih plinova, koji su navodno najodgovornije za klimatske promjene, jest proizvodnja hrane. Kako planiraju riješiti taj problem? Upravo ste mogli vidjeti kako. Potpuna promjena prehrambenih navika, kako je gospodin Corbett nazvao food reset, je glavna preporuka u klimatskim politikama. Karbonski otisak kao mjerna jedinica kreiranja antropogenih stakleničkih plinova će biti znatno lakšim mjerama mjerena u realnom vremenu, što će nam omogućiti digitalna transformacija. Transformirat će nam industriju, proizvodnju, energiju, kretanje, izgradnju, poljoprivredu, šume i otpad. Detaljno piše u izvještaju koji je napravila poznata svjetska konzultantska kompanija McKinsey, koji među ostalima kaže da ćemo izdvojiti u tu svrhu 9% GDP-a do 2030. a 6% GDP-a do 2050. kako bi postali karbon neutralni. Ako nekog zanima više o ovoj temi, može naći na web stranici slobodnipodcast.hr ili na mojim profilima na društvenim mrežama ako nisu uklonili ministarstva istine pod nazivom Fact Checkeri. Čuli ste kako se možemo boriti protiv ovakve budućnosti, dok još imamo priliku. Jednostavno, prilikom svake kupnje imate moć odlučiti kome ćete dati svoj novac. Proizvođaču svježe i zdrave hrane na poljoprivrednim površinama ili korporacijama koji će kupce i printerno meso staviti na svoje police. Također je u vašim rukama hoćete li ostati anonimni u svojoj kupnji plaćajući gotovinom dok još imamo ili ćete ostavljati karbonski otisak plaćajući karticama koji ga već na veliko mjere. O tome koliko planetu uistinu treba zaštita od nas ljudi sam napravio nekoliko emisija i to vam preporučam da pogledate. Hvala lijepa na pažnji i vidimo se u sljedećoj epizodi Slobodnog.
Nitko vas neće natjerati da se poklonite žiri, učinit ćete to svoje volje, odbacujući vjeru. Bićete laka meta za zvijeri, jer se niste podredili vjeri. Ako se ne podredite vjeri, podredit ćete se zvijeri. Toliko ćete se suobličiti sa ovim svijetom, da nećete ni prepoznati da ste u zabludi. Biće to najveća demonska prevara ikada. I pravedno zaslužena osuda nad nepokajanim grešnicima. Gdje su svi? Oh.